Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Francesca Minerva. She is a researcher at the University of Milan in Italy. She is the co-founder and co-editor of the Journal of Controversial Ideas. Her research focuses on applied philosophy, including Lucism, conscientious objection, abortion, academic freedom, and cryonics, and those are the topics we're going to talk about today. So, Francesca, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
Okay, so let's start. This topic is very interesting because 10 years ago or so, you published a very controversial paper about it. Let's start with abortion. So, what are your views on abortion?
So I'm one of the people who are in favor of abortion, so like pro-choice. The paper you mentioned, though, extended that pro-choice, some of the pro-choice arguments, to newborns. So, like, the reason why I'm in favor of abortion, and I think it's morally permissible to have an abortion, is that I think that embryos and fetuses don't really have a right to life, in the sense that they don't have any interest in being born. They don't have an interest at all. Therefore, they can't really be deprived or harmed or wronged when you terminate their biological life. Therefore, abortion is permissible. There are other arguments in favor of abortion that are most concerned about the mothers or women's right not to have children. But for me, the main argument is the argument based on the fact that fetuses and embryos can't be harmed if you end their existence, because they don't have the capacity to have projects for the future. They don't have the capacity to attribute a value to their own life. And when a living being doesn't have those capacities, there is no harm in ending their existence, because they wouldn't suffer any harm.
Yeah, and that also applies to newborns.
Yeah, and in this paper I co-authored that came out in the Journal of Medical Ethics in 2012, we extended the same argument to newborns. So it wasn't something that we observed first. So other philosophers, like John Harris, Peter Singer, and Michael Tooley, had already pointed out that those capacities are not don't appear in newborns or very young babies as well. But we pushed the argument following the abortion line. So we talked about afterbirth abortion, that to many people sounds like absolute nonsense. But the introduction of this new term was because we wanted to highlight the fact that there is a strong similarity between having an abortion and having so between the status of the fetus and the moral status of the newborn. Because a lot of people say that something very important happens when a fetus is born. And of course, from a legal perspective, from a psychological perspective, from a social perspective, it's true. So we didn't deny that, and I wouldn't deny that. Obviously, when a parent has their baby in their arms, and when the baby's outside of the womb, they become, it's possible for them to be given up for adoption. So definitely, from a legal, social, and psychological perspective, there is a difference between a fetus and a newborn. But what we wanted to stress is the fact that there is not a big difference when you look at the cognitive capacities of a fetus and the newborn, in the sense that if you're talking about their capacity to attribute a value to their own life, to have projects for the future, and all these other characteristics that some people think are relevant when we're talking about abortion, then those characteristics are also missing in newborns. So that's why we talked about afterbirth abortion.
I understand. And would these principles that you apply to an end-of-life situation like abortion, would they also apply to euthanasia?
In the case of euthanasia, it's quite different, I think, because the usually in the case of euthanasia, you have a grown-up person who had a life, hopefully a happy life, but they've got to the point of their life where their suffering is usually unbearable because of the largest case in the largest number of cases because of some health issues. So people who have cancer at a late stage, so they're in a lot of pain, they don't have much life left to live, and they're really living with a lot of pain. In some other cases, it can be psychological pain. I think there have been very few cases, but some cases in Holland and in Belgium of people who requested euthanasia because the depression was very severe and there was no way of curing it with the medications currently available. So in that case, the person definitely has the capacity to attribute a value to their life, and I think that's the reason why actually they ask for euthanasia, because they realize that to them, that kind of life they're living is really not worth living. It's more a burden than a joy, and therefore they want to exit existence without suffering more. So in that case, definitely there is the autonomous choice of ending life. In the case of a fetus, fetuses are not capable of any autonomous decisions. I mean, they don't have the cognitive capacities for that. So there are quite huge asymmetries between entering life and exiting life, so between abortion and euthanasia, because the mental capacities are very different.
And I know you're also very interested in cryonics. You even wrote an entire book on it, The Ethics of Cryonics. So could you tell us what cryonics is about and what are the sorts of arguments in favor of it?
Yeah, so cryonics, I don't know if everybody has heard of it. It's quite of an obscure topic, and indeed, I wrote the book. I think it's pretty much the only book on the ethics of cryonics. It's considered one of these very weird subjects, but I think it's a very interesting topic, not only because cryonics is inherently interesting, but also because of all the philosophical topics that are related to cryonics. So cryonics is the preservation at ultra low temperatures of a person who has been declared legally dead. So what happens when somebody is declared legally dead is that you have a few minutes between the heart so stop beating and before the brain starts experiencing like damage for lack of oxygen, in which the process of cryonics has to start. So you can't cryopreserve a person whose heart has stopped beating like 2 days before. It has to be quite quick. It's a matter of minutes. You start the process by decreasing the temperature of the person, for instance, in an ice bath, and then you start replacing the blood in the veins with a substance that doesn't freeze, because blood is made in largest part of water, and water in the cells expands when you freeze it, or at a very low temperature, so you want to avoid that because you don't want to cause damage to the body. And then these bodies are preserved in liquid nitrogen, which is also where we preserve embryos, for instance, the embryos that we use for in vitro fertilization. So they're kept in these facilities. I think there are two or three in the world, and for what we know, they can stay cryopreserved in that state indefinitely. And this is the first part and of cryonics. You figure out more or less how to do that. There are various places where you can get this procedure done. What we haven't really figured out yet is the second part of cryonics, which is how to revive these patients, these people, so that they can restart living. And of course, the second part is also very important, because the goal of cryonics is to extend the life of the patient. So, for instance, imagine the case of a person who has cancer, and they know they don't have much time left to live. Because the cancer is killing them, there is no cure. So what they can do is to have cryonics and hope that in the future, perhaps in 50 years, 100 years, there will be a treatment for the cancer so that they can be revived and the cancer can be cured. And ideally, this usually the idea is that cryonics should go paired with life extension as well. So suppose you have cancer at 80 and it's not possible to cure cancer, you have cryonics, then you come back after 50 years. Suppose in the future where we have found out a way to bring back to life the people who were cryopreserved, but also to cure cancer. But anyway, if we haven't really managed to also work on life extension, and you are brought back to life at 80, even if you're cancer free, if cryopreservation worked, your lifespan is going to be very limited. So you can live for maybe 10, 20 years at most. So the big project related to cryonics is that of indefinite life extension. So cryonics should be a step to sort of stay alive, to have a chance to come back to life. But the final goal should be that of having indefinite life extension and to live either forever or for a much longer time than we actually do now.
And that period during which the person is cryopreserved, should we consider the person to be dead or is she still alive?
That's a difficult question. So I think that we used to have this black and white view of being alive and being dead, and it was the case for all the human history until some medical technologies were introduced, and actually we now have a lot of gray areas. One is cryonics, and I'm going to explain why. But also, like, if you think of people in a vegetative state, these are people who are kept alive. They often have artificial nutrition and hydration, sometimes artificial ventilation, but they're not conscious. They're not really living their life. It's, in a sense, they're dead, and in many cases, indeed, if the family agrees, then you can remove the artificial ventilation, artificial hydration, and let them die. But obviously, there is a huge difference between you and me speaking now and having this conversation, and a person who is in a vegetative state in a hospital. They're not really dead, but they're not really alive. And this gray area has been introduced by technology, and cryonics is one of these technologies. So according to the definition of death that you use, You might say that people were cryopreserved are dead or alive. So, if you think that a person is dead when their heart stops beating, they're definitely dead. If you think that people are dead when their brain stops working, which is the most common definition of death that we use in hospitals in healthcare, then they're dead. Or some people use like a certain part of the brain. As a not the whole brain as it stops working, but anyway, by all of these medical definition that we use, they are dead. However, people who think the cryonics might be a chance to be shipped to the future, they think that actually there is a different account of death that we should take into consideration, and it's called information theoretical death. So the idea is that insofar as the information stored in your brain is not lost, is not so corrupted that you couldn't be able to rescue it, then you're not dead according to the information theoretical account of that. It means that if you think, I think this metaphor works really well. Like if you imagine, if you think of a computer, so if you save all the data, all the information, all the programs in your computer, you pretty much have like on your storage, like the copy of your computer, even if your computer as it is now, gets completely destroyed. You can still take that data and upload it on your computer, and you would have, for intents and purposes, the same computer you had before. Because what matters for your computer is not really the keyboard and the screen and other parts, it's the data that matters to you. And similar reason can apply, should apply. I think it actually applies to humans. So, again, like those people in the hospital in a vegetative state, if the data in their brain has gone lost because, for instance, they had like a very bad accident and their brain got severe injuries, the data can't be taken, can't be resumed, can't be saved. So, according to this account, even though they are breathing and their body is still working, they are dead because they will never get back their all their information, which is all your memories, all your mental states. It's pretty much you. I mean, in a sense, we are our brain. So according to this account, what cryonics is doing is making sure that the information in your brain doesn't get corrupted, doesn't get lost. And the hope is that in the reviving process, when we revive the people from cryonics, it will never be able to do that. That information, or at least large part of the information, will still be there so that you can be revived from cryonics after another 20, 50, 100 years. And you can say, oh, it's me. I remember. I feel like myself, even though you've been posed for a long time. If cryonics doesn't achieve that goal, if people wake up and it's like completely blank, or like their body is working but their brain is not really working, or then it has failed in a sense. So what matters is that the information is not corrupted. And I think in that sense, again, like it depends on whether, which account of death you use. So are they dead or alive? Well, it depends on what you mean by dead or alive. A doctor in a hospital will tell you, yes, they're definitely dead because their brain is not working. But a cryonicist will tell you, no, they're not really dead because there is a chance that they're the data, the memories, everything in their brain will come back when we revive them. So it's hard to tell if yes or no. It's a difficult answer.
This raises another interesting question. At a certain point, you mentioned that one potential goal of cryonics would be to extend life indefinitely. But would this be a good thing? Would someone becoming immortal be a good thing?
It is something philosophers have discussed for a very long time. And I think that the majority of philosophers got to the conclusion that it would be bad to live indefinitely, to be mortal. The main reason is that they think some of the main reasons that life would be boring. So eventually, after living for so long, you'll be bored, or your life wouldn't really feel human, because to be human means to have limited time, and when you have infinite time, that's not human life anymore, so your life would be unrecognizable as a human. Other people have argued that you wouldn't recognize your life as your life, because the time span would be so long that you would get lost in all these years you've been living, so we can keep only ourselves together if we live for a short time. I think these are some of the main arguments, like the idea that death anyway gives a meaning to life, that we understand life only in relation to death. I think there are some good points there, but I think that it's hard to tell if we don't try. And I think that in part the reason why we think about a very long life being extremely boring is that perhaps we imagine people like aging and becoming more and more decrepit and less able of doing the things they like. So as we age, we become weaker, we have less energy, we lose health, we can do much less, we lose part of the memory and the people around us, like start having like people dying or age and so on. So if you imagine that process continuing indefinitely, that obviously looks horrible and nobody would sign up for that. But if you could pair getting older, if you could unmatch getting older and aging, I think that would be a much different story. So if we could, as I said before, like the plan of cryonics is like to be linked to indefinite life extension, and indefinite life extension is also linked to rejuvenating technology. So if we can stop aging, or reverse aging, then getting older, living 500, 2000 years would look very, very different. Imagine having the same energy you have when you're 20 or 30 forever. That would be a completely different experience from, living up to 100 and being very fragile and old. It is less likely, I think, that we would get bored of living, just because we had opportunity of doing so many things, like we could travel places. We would have the energy of doing these things. We would have the energy of achieving a lot of other goals that now we can't achieve. Now, the more we live, the more we have doors closing in front of us. Like, you make a choice, you can't undo it, and then you just have to continue in that way. And I think that's tragic. I think that's tragic that we can't really undo life. A lot of things we can't really undo. Like, once you have sex for the first time, you're no longer, not gonna be a virgin ever again, even if you live for a million years. So some things, even with endless times, can't be undone. But for a lot of other things, like I chose in this life to be a philosopher, but maybe I would have, it would have been interesting to have a different life in which I would have done a different job, or lived in a different place. There are so many options, and we just never experienced that because we always get old and age at the same time. And I'm so surprised that people don't really care about aging that much. Seems to me that it's such a tragic thing that happens to everyone, to age, like all of the diseases we experience, from Parkinson, Alzheimer, cancer, we know they're very strictly related to aging. And we're trying to fix them, which is great, but we should fix aging because aging is the source of all of this. And even if you get to your 90s without a particular disease, you're still not going to be in good shape. It's still going to be more difficult, more boring for you to live compared to when you're 20. Yeah, I find it's really strange that people are not freaking out about aging. I'm freaking out. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things we should work on. Like, why do we age? Why can't we stop it? What are we doing?
Yeah, so changing topics now, you also talk about wokeism in your work. So why should we worry about biases in favor of attractive people or against unattractive people?
I think we should worry about biases against unattractive people most of all, because we know from a lot of research in psychology and in economics that unattractive people have a lot of disadvantages. It has been measured from an economic perspective, so we know that unattractive people earn less compared to average-looking people, and average-looking people earn less than sorry, I need a sip of water.
Sure.
And attractive people earn more than average-looking people. I think it's like $120,000 on average, but of course, depend on your job and how attractive and attractive you are. But it's quite a lot of money, and we know that unattractive people struggle more to find a job, and they're called back less when they send their CV. They have a lot of disadvantages in, related to the work area, but not all that. Maybe people have already the intuition that it's more difficult to find a partner if you're less attractive, especially for men, but same for women. So your romantic life is going to be affected, obviously, by how attractive you are or not. There is some evidence that attractive people are more likely to win the elections as well, or to raise more money for charity. So it seems to affect a lot of areas of life. So, like, whether you're raising money for a charity, or you're in politics, you're a student, the way you interact with other people, your friends. There are so many areas of human experience that are affected by how attractive and attractive we are. It seems to me that this disadvantage should be discussed. Like, the term lookism refers to more known forms of discrimination, such as racism, ageism, and so on and so forth. But I think the lookism has been really underestimated. Like, we know that it affects the life of people, it seems that it doesn't raise my attack and doesn't prompt much reflection in philosophy. I think it got better in the last few years when I started working on this topic. Nobody was working on it. Now there are a few more people, so I think there's made some progress there. But I think it's not really enough yet. So the issue is there indeed. Like, not that the attractive people have an advantage, good for them, but of course that. The problem is that the unattractive people have a disadvantage. So some people say that, well, we shouldn't really do anything about it. It's just a matter of luck. what are we gonna do? I think that's too dismissive. If we know that a group of people suffers from a form of discrimination, the least we can do is start looking into it. I think there are like different kind of actions that we can take. Well, first of all, I think people should become aware of the fact that there is this form of discrimination. I think that helps a lot, just to acknowledge our own lookism. Like, am I behaving in a different way towards the person who's attractive? Am I being more dismissive of what they're saying just because they're unattractive? I'm not saying that everybody does that, but there is enough evidence that most people do that. Like, we don't really realize it's a form of implicit bias. But it seems there is quite enough evidence that actually we are quite lookist. So first of all, we start acknowledging that we are lookist, and we start reflecting on our behavior and actions that can start making a difference. The other thing is whether, like, among the people who agree about the need to intervene to change the lookist bias, or to do something about it. Some people say that the only thing we should do is to intervene socially, so promoting more equality, but also perhaps introducing anti-lookism legislations. For instance, similar to the ones that address discrimination against disabled people, or racist behaviors in the workplace or in society. And that's definitely something we could consider, something worth discussing. But I think that can achieve a lot, but I don't think that's the whole story. I don't think that addressing the social part of lookism is going to solve the problem. I think that in some cases, at least, perhaps in the worst cases, we need to intervene also medically. So what we have now is cosmetic surgery. I think that people were victim of lookism and want to do something about it, and we have good reasons to believe they actually experience that. Of course, if Brad Pitt says I'm a victim of lookism, we would laugh at that. That's not true, but like, if there is like a medical assessment and people can agree, okay, yes, you are quite an attractive according to these standards of beauty, then I think it would make sense to provide free cosmetic surgery. And indeed, a lot of countries already do that. I mean, not for all cases, but there is some free cosmetic surgery for people. For instance, people, like young children, can have their ears pinned back if they have protruding ears in most countries. And it's not because protruding ears are the most or the worst facial features, are just because it's very easy and very cheap to fix them. But then it seems kind of unfair to say, well, if your an attractive feature is protruding ears, we'll do it for free. If your unattractive feature is, I don't know, your nose or your chin or something else, well, sorry, no, you can't have it for free. It seems like a really irrational way of distributing resources or addressing the issue that a person is experiencing. So I think that we should provide more free cosmetic surgery for people who request it and need it. And perhaps in the future, we will be able to use genetic intervention to intervene before. So instead of pinning the ears back when the child is born, perhaps there is like a little gene we can tweak to make sure that that's not developed. And same goes for any other feature. I think that the main disagreement about the strategy that is best to use to address lookism comes from a disagreement about the source of lookism, and again about the source of our aesthetic preferences. Some people believe that the aesthetic preferences are entirely induced by society. They are just a byproduct of society. And if we change society, then we can change aesthetic preferences. And I think it's true for some features. So, for instance, our preference for very skinny women, or for oh no, blonde hair or white skin, that's a society induced preference. We're not evolved to have that preference. But there is also some evidence suggesting that our aesthetic preferences are a byproduct of evolution, at least some of them are. So, like our preference for symmetry, it's a byproduct of evolution. We like symmetrical things, we like also symmetrical bodies and symmetrical faces. Our preference for smooth skin is also a byproduct of evolution. There are some features that it's really difficult to get rid of. Like we're evolved to prefer these things. It's like we've evolved to prefer sugary food than foods that are less calorie dense, and that's just like because during our evolutionary history that having sugary food increased our chances of surviving. Same goes for some features. So there used to be like evolving, like there is a link between like symmetry and health, or like good skin and health. Of course, now it doesn't really matter because we have medicine. So, but imagine like a society in which, like a time where, there was like the plague, and like if people had like signs of plague on their face, that was a very useful indication that the person was contagious and that you shouldn't get close to them. And well, even if now, maybe people had the plague and were not contagious because medicine can fix it, or the plague were not as lethal. We still have that preference because we've evolved with that preference, and that goes for a lot of aesthetic preferences we have. We're born with them, so I think that in those cases, it becomes very difficult to say, "Oh well, society, we should change." Society is responsible for the preference for symmetry. Well, that's not true. Maybe in continuing our evolution, we will get rid of that preference. But right now, I don't think we can change the preference for symmetry by changing society. I think we can change the preference for skinny people by changing society because, yeah, that's not something we have evolved with, quite to the contrary. But some preferences are just like hardwired in our brain. So I think people disagree a lot about what strategy to use to fight leukism, because they disagree a lot about what is the source, the origin of our aesthetic preferences.
So we've been talking about some medical procedures and the ethics behind them, like abortion, euthanasia, cosmetic surgery, cryonics. There's one aspect that we haven't talked about yet, that is conscientious objection. So I don't know if you want to apply it to these cases or others, but what are the kinds of situations where it is morally permissible for doctors to evoke conscientious objection and not perform one of these practices?
I don't think there is any case where it's morally permissible for a doctor to refuse to perform an abortion, for instance. I guess it depends a lot on the kind of treatment. So, but if a treatment is legal in a certain country, then it seems to me that the good doctor is the doctor who performs all the treatments that are made available in the country where they live. So, for instance, in Italy, we have a lot of cases of doctors who refuse to perform abortion, or even to prescribe the morning after pill. And some pharmacists refuse to sell the morning after pill, even with a prescription, because in Italy you need a prescription. There are also nurses or doctors who refuse to help the patient who had an abortion. Always about to have an abortion, so they don't want to give it an aesthetic, for instance, because they don't want to be involved in the abortion because they think they are complicit in wrongdoing. I understand that if you think that abortion is equivalent to murder, then you don't want to be involved in any activity. So you don't want to tell people how to get somebody who performs a murder for you. You don't want to give them any information that they can use to kill somebody. You just like murder is such a horrible thing to do that you don't want to be involved. So if you think that abortion is murder, I understand that doctors don't want to be involved. But then the solution is not to become the kind of doctor who performs abortions. Like in Italy, it's mostly gynecologist. You just should go in a different area of medicine because the health system and the scientific community have decided that that's a treatment that we should provide to patients. And the patients have a right to good health assistance. And therefore, the doctor has the professional obligation to perform it. So I think that a lot of people who are against conscientious objections, like me, they tend to think like, oh well, but the doctor is wrong. It's not really, we shouldn't really consider the their concerns about complicity. They're not really complicit. I think they are complicit. I think they're perfectly right in not wanting to be involved in something they consider to be immoral. I think they're wrong in thinking that's immoral, but that's completely irrelevant. But I think that when you're a doctor, then you have the duty to perform the legal, safe procedures that the country you live in has asked you to perform. Different is the case if you want an abortion in a country where abortion is illegal, or if you want euthanasia in a country where it's illegal. That's a completely different issue. Of course, you can say no, you shouldn't do illegal things. But if the procedure is legal and the patient is entitled to have it, you have to perform it.
So now talking about another topic, I wanted to know more about the Journal of Controversial Ideas. So I've had on the show Peter Singer and Jeff McMahon, the other two co-founders of the journal. Why did you decide to create this journal? I mean, what are the sorts of issues that you find in academia and perhaps in other journals that you want to tackle with this journal?
Well, after I published that article that we mentioned at the beginning, I got a lot of death threats and I noticed that I wasn't really getting job offers, and some job offers were taken back, or like they were told like we can't offer you this job because you're too controversial. And people started coming to me and tell me like, oh well, you were really brave. I couldn't have done that. And there are some, maybe I agree with you, but I would never say that in public. So I started realizing that there was a lot of fear around publishing controversial ideas in academia. But I thought it was an isolated case. I mean, I knew that Peter Singer already had some death threats, and he had been attacked during some presentations, and like he had been disinvited from conferences and so on and so forth. But I thought, okay, well, it's just a few cases. But then time passed by, and I started realizing that this was becoming more and more common. And I think the been cases of quite a lot of cases now of academics that had they lost their jobs, or they got petitions signed against them because they published a paper considered controversial. And that seemed very dangerous to me, because in academia you have to be able to discuss all ideas, even the ones that are controversial, because academia is not about discussing the world how you would like it to be. It's about trying to find the truth. So if people are really scared about presenting new models or talking about ideas because they think that, they're gonna have a petition against them or they're gonna be fired, then we're not really helping them to find the truth to do their job. So we thought that the journal could be a good option for people who want to share these ideas to get closer to the truth without having to have petitions against them, because in our journal you can publish anonymously or using a pseudonym actually. So people can still share their ideas, so their ideas can be out there. But hopefully they will not be attacked by colleagues or people who want to get rid of them professionally, or in my case it was also like physically. So the idea is that to provide a space for discussing ideas without too much emphasis on the person who wrote the idea, because we are in academia to discuss ideas, not people. And a lot of these attacks are really towards the person, not toward the idea. And that's really not what academia should be.
But what are controversial ideas in this case? Because since it is still an academic journal, I mean, are there any limits in terms of the ideas that you accept being published there?
If the idea is well, if the paper is well argued, and we have a very tough peer review. If it goes through peer review and it's accepted, and the experts agree it's a good paper, the topic is not a problem. One thing we're not gonna publish is like somebody giving like detailed instruction about how to build weapons or a super virus, so anything that can be an immediate threat, so things like that. But apart from that, insofar as talking about ideas, that there is, I don't think there should be any limit to the ideas that can be discussed if it's done in good faith and with empirical evidence or good reasoning.
So, and I think this will be my final question. So, do you think that nowadays we have more backlash against controversial ideas in expressed in academia than before? And do you think that, for example, things like the internet facilitate that because it's easier to for even anonymous people to reach the authors and threatening them in any way or something like that?
I think it depends on where you're comparing. If you're comparing to like 30, 40, 20 years ago, I think we have less academic freedom and it's less safe. But I was reading books about like the Enlightenment and what the situation was during the Enlightenment. And of course, like there was less academic freedom, and think of people like Socrates. So this is not a new. A new phenomenon, but it's definitely new in compared to a few years ago where we had more academic freedom. I think that the internet made a difference at least in some cases, but because now it has become like everybody can jump on the list of people attacking you. So like there is more interest in what academics do as well, which I think is great. I think that's amazing that the internet has allowed people to know about my research on the research a lot of other people, and it's actually like one of the best things that happened in academia in the last years. But it comes with a price. So the problem though is not, I used to think, I've changed my mind about that. I used to think that the problem was people sending you death threats and attacking you for something controversial you had written. because I experienced that myself. But I've changed my mind about that. I don't think that's the problem. I think that's fine. I mean, I don't think it's nice to send a death threat, but anyway, it's perfectly fine with me at least. But what is the problem is the reaction of the institutions. So, like, if people get angry, and but people can be like the general public, can be students, can be colleagues signing petitions. If the university fires you because people have disagree with you, and you know they write a petition, that's a huge problem. But that doesn't come from the people necessarily. That's the just institution that are really failing us. They're failing academia. They're not defending and protecting the academic freedom of the people working from them. They're just saying, "Oh, sorry, somebody doesn't like you. I guess I'll have to fire you." Well, no, that should never, never, never happen, unless somebody, you know, really violates some basic principles of, you know, like respect and defamation, like if, you know, committing. Doing something like really horrible to their colleagues. But if you're just writing your paper and you're just expressing your idea and you think you have arguments or data for some idea and you want to share it with your colleagues and have a conversation, like, "Oh, I think this. What do you think about it?" And your colleague should be, "Oh, no, I disagree with you. I think that, you know, you didn't analyze this data properly, or you didn't consider this counter argument." That's how you make progress. And he's like, "Oh yes, you're right. Oh, let me change that. Oh, like, let me analyze these other elements." But that's not what happens anymore. So you publish a controversial paper, you're gonna have a petition of people trying to fire you, and then the university fires you. How are we gonna make any progress in this situation where people just get angry and or you know or fired? I'm seriously worried about this situation, and I really hope that the Journal of Controversial Ideas will help to make a change in this direction.
So, just one final question. This came to my mind now. Do you think that the biggest threats to academic freedom come from within academia itself or from other sources, like, I don't know, the general public or politicians or others?
I think it's all connected, but I think right now the main threat to academia is probably coming from academics, like those academics who want to get their colleagues fired. But the effect of this change in institution, like this is a very new phenomenon that didn't happen up to 5 years ago, like. You know, most cases, like maybe there have been a few cases, but like academics denouncing other academics and asking for them to be fired, that's, you know, that's really quite new. But also, I mean, that I think that then society gets involved. So like we are creating an environment which we're telling people, you know, it's okay to overreact. It's okay to try to silence, like, or at least we're telling our students, it's okay to try to silence speakers you don't want to hear to. It's okay to try to remove from the syllabus the topics you don't want to have discussed. But that's not how we teach, right? I mean, like, our job as teachers is to help the students to think critically, to think for themselves, to learn to disagree. They don't have to learn just all the things that they already agree with. They have to learn to deal with people who think differently. And I think we're failing them in that respect because now when students say, "I don't want to talk about a topic, I want to remove that topic from the syllabus, I don't want to do that reading," it's like, "Oh, okay, well, that's perfectly fine. Let's remove it." But that's not really what we should do. I think we should take into account their preferences. We should discuss with them. We should explain and be really careful and not just like throwing information at them without helping them. Because, yeah, some students can be more sensitive, but I think it's really an important skill to learn to disagree, to learn to consider all the different arguments. I mean, this is philosophy. It is about bouncing ideas and about, talking to each other. And it's really enriching to disagree. We can't really make any progress at all if we never find somebody who disagrees with us. Like the best ideas I had, like the way I had improved my thinking and my papers was just talking about these ideas with people who had a completely different view. I owe everything to them because otherwise I would have not really improved. And I really want students and other people to learn to enjoy the process of disagreeing, to be exposed to things that make us feel uncomfortable for a little bit, but then we reflect upon our feeling uncomfortable and we can make a better argument. That's, it doesn't have to be necessarily a very pleasant process all the way, but when you learn to recognize that it feels like, oh yeah, now I feel that way, I feel uncomfortable because this is touching a chord I'm very sensitive about. Why am I very sensitive? Why am I feeling like this? And then you get out, come up with a better argument, and that's amazing. And that's the best part of philosophy.
Okay, great. So let's end on that note. Just before we go, would you like to mention any places on the internet where people can find your work?
Yes, I have a website that I should take better care of. It's called francescaminerva.com. And if you want to visit also like the Journal of Controversial Ideas, it's journalofcontroversialideas.org. And we haven't published the first issue yet, but we think it will come out in April. It's open access, so it's for free for everybody to read. And if you want to make a small donation, we also have like a PayPal button on our website. Yes, that's it. Thank
Okay, I will be leaving all of that in the description box of the interview. And
you.
Francesca, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise, thank you so much.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. My channel is now more than 3 years old, and to keep it sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. If you prefer PayPal, you can also find links to it in the description box of this interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Pereira Galarsen, Lau Guerreiro, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimir, Craig Healy, Adam Kessel, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wyss, Elanian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arnaud Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alanias, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nassi, Arthur Coe, Zoop, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Colombo, Jorge Espinha, Phil Cavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blyth, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Landry, F. Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Ivan Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Liebrandt, Özlem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Deza Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Usmani, Charlotte Please, Miren B, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, my producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Ian Gilligan, Sérgio Quadriano, Luís Caetano, Tom Vanagdom, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardas France, and Nirban Balachandran. And finally, my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, and Matthew Lavender. Thank you for all.